Hello, and welcome to SF Crossing the Gulf. I'm Karen Burnham.
And I'm Karen Lord.
And we are here today talking with Nathan Ballingrud, the author of the multiple award-winning collection, North American Lake Monsters, and specifically his story, The Good Husband. Welcome, Nathan.
Hi, thanks.
And let's see, so I wanted to let everyone know that the podcast immediately previous to this one had Karen Ward and I talking about The Good Husband, along with a story translated from Korean called The Fruit of My Woman by Han Kang. We're not going to re-summarize the stories. So what we'd ask everyone to do is, if this is your very first time listening to us, go back, listen to the one just before this one, and then that way we'll be able to, everyone will be on the same page as we start talking to Nathan about his story in particular. So, Karen, I know we talked a little bit about the multiple layers that this story really, really rewards reading and rereading. So where did you want to start with that?
Well, there are three possible views that came very strongly to me. The main one, of course, is your perfect zombie horror depiction. You know, that's all perfectly there. And then the secondary one being the metaphor for the sort of the breakdown of a marriage, the death of a marriage, not really so much necessarily the death of a person, but of the bond. And that was one of the things that we were looking at when we contrasted it, of course, with The Fruit of My Woman. But then there were flashes, and I don't know if it kind of felt particularly poignant to me because of some things happening in my own personal circle of friends of mine who have aging parents. But it also felt a lot like when a loved one has Alzheimer's, dementia or something, and you have this slow death, as it were, this slow changing transformation into something different. And, you know, sometimes the stories that we mean to write are not the stories that come out, or sometimes readers bring new things. But I wanted to ask Nathan what he had in mind when he was putting it together. What kind of hints and marvels were you putting into it?
It was very much the last one that you mentioned that was forefront in my mind. The idea of a couple who are trying to contend with, I wasn't thinking of Alzheimer's, I was thinking of depression, but I think that, you know, either can work. The way that the presence of that in a relationship affects the relationship in some ways, and specifically in the way that someone tries to deal with it and doesn't deal with it well, and the guilt that they feel over the thoughts that they, you know, the uncharitable thoughts that they have sometimes. So, you know, in the beginning of the story, when he comes up and finds his wife has tried to commit suicide, he has this moment where he thinks, maybe I should just let this happen, and and he feels terrible about that later. But I think that those kinds of feelings, I suspect, are not all that uncommon in moments of great stress.
Not at all. Yeah.
And that was that was really what catalyzed it, and what the thing was kind of about, you know, for me.
And the scene where he makes that choice is, for me, so powerful, especially because it comes so early, because it's really the key for of what happens next. But it's so incredibly powerful, and you feel so much for the protagonist. You feel so much for Sean. And then you do something really, really scary. You kind of slowly show us that maybe we shouldn't be as sympathetic to Sean as the beginning of the story suggests.
Yeah, it's. Yeah. I was just going to say that I wanted people to feel conflicted about Sean, because I do. Mm-hmm. I remember in an early draft of the story, I took it to the Sycamore Hill Writers Workshop. And they were looking at it, and they said, well, of course we're not going to like Sean, because the, you know, the title is clearly going to be ironic. And he was a lot more unsympathetic, I thought, in that earlier draft. And when I heard them say that, I kind of took a step back, because I didn't want him to be a cookie cutter, you know, callous, unlikable person. I wanted him to be both, you know, because I feel like most of us are both.
That is one of the things that really struck me about this story is you're giving us Sean's point of view, and there are things about him that are very understandable and very relatable. And then there are things where you're like, and now you've gone off the deep end and you don't really know it about yourself, do you? You know, there's a point where it seems like the author knows, you know, that the character is making horrible choices and doing very wrong things. And the character's like, doo-doo-doo, I'm still trying to be the good guy here.
Exactly.
And that's such a hard line to write.
I don't remember it being hard, although I know that it was. I don't know if it was objectively hard in that sense. It was hard in the way that all stories are hard. You know, you kind of get lost. You lose your way in them. At least I do almost all the time. As far as his psychology, it's, I don't know. It felt like a track, you know, it felt like once I was able to figure out how he thought, it was not that hard to figure out how he would go off the rails.
Mm. He knew what kind of mistakes he would make.
Yeah, I think so. He was so invested in his own definition of himself and in the definition of what his relationship was and what family meant that, you just crank that to the left and to the right a couple of degrees and it becomes, pretty distorted pretty quickly.
Yeah. You cranked that one up to 11. That was pretty great. Yeah. and of course, when he starts to speak in a way that's very isolating, where, she's crying out for help. The daughter later on is crying out for help. And he's like, no, we can fix this. We can deal with this. You know, if we let in other people, they'll take you away from me. And I was like, oh my goodness, that's like one part simply scary and you're kind of feeling sympathy. And another part, this is the language of abuse. This is the language of someone who, isolates you so that you can't get help from anybody else but them. So,
Well, and that really, when I realized that we were going to be able to talk with you directly, that was one question that really was on my mind was, in your mind, I mean, obviously, everybody's going to bring their own reading to a story, but in your mind, would you say that Sean is simply somebody, dealing with a situation and then dealing with it badly? Or had he always had abusive tendencies, even before the opening of the story? Because especially bits of the dialogue with the daughter, Heather, it seems like that opens up a little bit, that possibility.
Yeah, to be honest, I haven't thought about it, in a direct way. I think not overtly. I think he would certainly never recognize himself in conjunction with that word. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen or that there weren't elements of that. But I think that he was, I think his definition of what love is and what the family is, all that is narcissistically based. And I think that, that he needed other people to conform to that in order for him to recognize it. And, it's one of the reasons I wanted to have his daughter come back. Is because by that point in the story, we've spent so much time in his mind and in her mind too, both perspectives of which are going in different directions far off of normal. I wanted to bring, the daughter in. So this is, so there could be, kind of a quick realignment into what normal is supposed to be and her horror at both of them, is meant to kind of throw that into relief. Yeah, I don't think he ever meant to be. I think probably though he was through his own inability to look at life objectively, to look at his family objectively, and at himself objectively. If that makes any sense.
Oh yes, it does. And especially as you said, holding on to that image of what the good husband and the good family in his mind, instead of listening to what others' needs were. And I have to say, you did a perfect job with Heather as the normal objective observer, because she was pretty much our favorite.
yes.
In the sense of reacting like any normal person would. It was almost like a bit of a reader insert, where you could be like, I'm actually not imagining things. This is messed up.
and I remember my comment to Karen, especially in the in our recording, was, and I hope the very next thing she did after closing that door was call 911. Because dear Lord, somebody in that story had to.
At the very least, maybe she did, or at the very least, she felt like a lot of people feel in families that are kind of, drowning in dysfunction, is I must separate myself from this. You know, mm-hmm. if you people can't recognize it yourself, then I'm going to go and save myself. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe she did call someone. I would hope that she did too. But at the very least, she got out.
Yes, right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, and one thing that I thought was one thing I really appreciated, and that, you know, because it's funny when you take the premise of a story and you can take the same premise and you can make it a horror story or a science fiction story or a fantasy story. And one of the places where I really felt like this, you know, landed solidly in horror as opposed to science fiction or fantasy is when Sean's thinking, why is this happening to me? Mm-hmm. Instead of, what on earth is happening to my wife who is turning into a zombie?
Right.
And that puts it sort of, you know, it really keeps the focus on the psychological horror of what's going on.
Yeah, which is the only part that really interests me. It's funny, I hadn't even thought about the word zombie in conjunction with the story until months later after it was published. Someone mentioned
Seriously?
It was a zombie story.
Oh my goodness.
And I was like, oh, I guess. I'm really like dumb about these things sometimes. And I was like, oh yeah, it is a zombie story, isn't it? I didn't realize that's what it was, but obviously it is. But yeah, the psychological aspect of it was by far the most interesting thing to me about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I have to make a confession. I may have told you this many, many, many years ago when I first got this book in my hands. I usually do not read horror. It takes a lot for me to be able to read a horror story, watch a horror movie, anything at all to do with horror. But there's something so compelling about this story that I keep coming back to. A good part of it is the fact that the way you said it was only months later, you're like, oh yeah, it's a zombie story. Because you're just drawn into the whole psychology of it. That's really what you're looking at. You're looking at this, as you say, dysfunctional family, this dysfunctional pair. And you are looking at the whole dynamic of that, and the fact that she's kind of undead seems almost peripheral. I really have to say that it's got a lot of power for that. I should mention Thank that you. When I taught it in a workshop, I had about half of the students, especially those who did like horror, saying, oh, this was amazing, thank you. And then there were others who were giving me very hurt looks and saying it was torture. Yeah. Because they didn't read horror and they found it so like upsetting to read some of the images and so forth. And I did warn them. I warned them. I said, look, this is going to be difficult, but I want you to look at this as an example of craft. And there were two reasons why I gave it to them that I'm going to tell you right now. The first is that it's a longish short story, but not a single paragraph is wasted. I was trying to explain to them that when you're doing a short story, when you're doing the short form, every single paragraph has to count, has to lead somewhere, has to add something. Because, you know, I mean, sometimes when you're writing a novel, I'm guilty of this, you feel you can give yourself a little filler. You can wander down the path for a bit, not quite Tom Bombadil, but, you know, you can expand a bit. But when you've got the short form.
I think that's one of the pleasures of a novel.
Exactly. But when you've got the short form, you got to be very, not only disciplined, but beautifully focused. And it was for them to see, to acknowledge that there was nothing, when I say gratuitous, I'm not talking about gratuitous or gratuitous violence. There were no gratuitous flights of fancy, words, anything. Every single thing pulled together. So that was one. Thank you very much for that. And the other thing I wanted them to notice was that, because sometimes you do get people in workshops who think that to write something horrific, to write about violence, to write about, you know, the supernatural in a way that makes people feel chilled, you have to make it as ugly as possible.
Right.
And what kind of killed me about this story in a good way is that you use some beautiful language. Like there were paragraphs I would actually stop and just like do a little reread and go, Wow, he's given me this beautiful little gift right here. Okay, I'm probably going to come up on a really horrible scene later on, but I can just enjoy this one right here. And somehow that actually made me more vulnerable in a good way as a reader to what was happening in the story. That was more of
you.
A comment than
a
question.
I think aesthetic and specifically, I think beauty and horror, I think, are a lot closer, more closely related, or at least can be, and perhaps should be, than people might initially think. I think I first experienced this as a reader with Clive Barker when I read his Books of Blood anthologies, came out in the '80s. You know, it's, the covers were garish. The title is almost antagonistic. It tells mm-hmm. you, it doesn't prepare you for the layers and the beauty that you find inside. Beautiful language, mm-hmm. the notion of horror as a mechanism for transformation. Which is something that I kind of viscerally respond to. And it's something that I, you know, try to do myself when I can. It's, I think using the tropes or the tools of horror to be disgusting or to be ugly, as you said, is, I mean, it's I guess it's certainly a valid use, but it's not a one that I have a lot of interest in. Mm-hmm. I like the beauty that you can find in it. I like the unconventional ways of looking at something beautiful or describing something as beautiful. And I think looking at it through that sort of almost gothic lens is just, for reasons I can't really say, just personally really appealing. That's just, I guess it's just how my soul is wired.
Well, that's another thing that I really appreciate. It's funny when Karen and I go over stories like this and I get a chance to read the same story, you know, two or even three times, which is obviously when I'm reading, you know, several dozen stories a month for Locus Magazine, I do not get that opportunity. It actually ends up going back to, God bless my junior year high school English teacher who taught a lot, who is in many ways not a great teacher, but taught very specific lessons on diction and word choice, and especially some of the scenes where you get the description from Katie's point of view, and then you see the same scene from Sean's point of view, and I'm thinking specifically of when she visits a cemetery. You know, the word choices, you know, just completely nail down what her perspective is, what his perspective is, and how completely divorced they are. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not seeing the same reality at all at that point.
Yeah.
I mean, how, when you're writing, do you do a lot of revising, or does it kind of, are you one of the writers who it all just kind of flows at once, or what's your style on that?
Well, I wouldn't use the word flow. It's very slow. I don't do a lot of revising, but I think because of that, it tends to come very, very slowly and often with difficulty. Yeah. When I do revise, it's generally to just, you know, to shave off the rough edges, but I'll sit down and think about something forever before it gets on the page. And maybe that's why. And it's, and I've always found it kind of the one thing maybe that I find easy about writing. I find very little of it easy, but the one thing that I don't seem to have a lot of trouble with is just sliding into different people's points of view. I think it's like the most important, or one of the most important things that I think literature can do is to help create empathy. This notion of surrendering our preconceptions and trying to see what the world looks like from somebody's point of view who on the surface is objectionable in some way. You know, or anything. I was like, the perspectives in this story, I wanted very much for each person's perspective to seem defensible. You know, I want the reader to be able to look through his point of view and say, I get it. I get why he thinks this. I get why he's coming to this conclusion. He does, of course, obviously, you know, goes off too far, but I want the reader to be able to see the chain of events that takes him there. And the same thing with her, you know, she's going in a completely different place, but I want the reader to be able to understand why. And so when they can't apprehend the world in the same way anymore at all, when there's like no overlap in how they see things, I want it to make sense to the reader in both directions. Who knows if I succeeded in that, but that's generally like what I try to do. I think in most stories, I'm just fascinated by the way. Well, I'm fascinated by, I'm, how to say this best. I think I think that we are so entrenched so often in our own points of view that we forget that the person who sees something differently, 9 times out of 10, there's a chain of reactions, a chain of events, circumstances that brought them to that place. And I'm curious about those. You know, I'm curious about the roots of different perspectives. And I think I've gone off of your question, but.
Oh, we encourage rambling.
We encourage it, absolutely. Yeah. You're kind of sparking me to think something else. I would actually not disagree with you that it's one of the important things that literature can do. I think it is, in a way, the most important thing that literature can do. It's certainly what I tell myself when I question whether what I do is useful or not. but what I was going to add is that one of the joys, in a way, about reading a story like yours is that you can understand why a person does terrible things and they're still terrible things.
Yes.
There's a sort of an interesting, I'm going to say the term value neutral as a sociologist, which is to say you're examining as an objective observer. And you can basically say, here are the very bad choices this person made. These are the very good reasons why these bad choices were encountered, you know. But ultimately, the outcomes were suboptimal. And, you know, you get a kind of, to be able to have that view is incredibly useful because sometimes the inclination as human beings with emotions is to try to slap a value on it, slap a judgment on it. Sort of like, okay, now he's definitely the villain, full stop. And he is a villain, you know, right. I'm not saying he's not the villain, but he's a villain who you have walked with. He's a villain who you have, you know, seen how you yourself could have gone down that slippery slope. And it gives you some information that is useful about how you approach life from then on.
Hopefully you can recognize that he's a villain, you being the subjective, you can recognize that he's a villain, but also recognize why he doesn't think that he is or why he can't recognize that in himself.
Yeah.
I think that kind of thing is endlessly fascinating to me.
Now, let's see. So I know we also wanted to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that have gone on. So this story has a 2013 date on it. And that's also the year that North American Lake Monsters came out. Obviously, you've been doing things since then, including some things involving Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah. A couple of years after that book came out, a novella was published called The Visible Filth. Mm-hmm. And that was optioned and made into a movie by Babak Anvari. He's an Iranian British writer director who's did a movie called Under the Shadow a couple of years ago. And yeah, and the movie's called Wounds. And it debuted at the Sundance a couple of weeks ago, or I guess a month ago now. It was extremely exciting. And it's hard for me really to kind of accept this as being like a part of my life, a thing that actually happened.
I was having a lot of fun watching your Twitter feed blowing up.
it was very surreal. It still feels like something separate, you know, like a little pocket universe that doesn't really fit into the daily life that I recognize. But it was very cool. I took my daughter to visit the set when they were filming it. And that was fun. And yeah, I guess it's going to, I don't think it has an official date yet. I think they're thinking June. It'll be interesting to see what people think. I think it's going to be a polarizing piece of work.
But I've noticed.
The novella was.
I think I saw you tweet about at least 2 reviews where you were extremely happy with how the reviewer had taken on the film, which is kind of rare. We're so accustomed to hearing horror stories from writers about how they made their work into a film and they completely butchered it. But you seem to be pretty happy about this.
Yeah, I am. And the reviews have been polarized, as I thought that it might be. This is definitely not the sort of movie that everyone's gonna dig. And he made some divergences from the novella for sure, but necessary ones. But he was remarkably faithful to it. Faithful to the extent that he took it to the same place that I did in the story. And that's the element that I think is going to polarize people. Mm. I think he did a terrific job. I couldn't be happier.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm anxious to see how it does, see how people react.
So are we going to get a chance to lay hands on the text version again?
Oh, yes. I guess I should talk about that. It's out in an ebook now from Saga Press and for a couple of months. And then the book is going to be coming out in April, another book of short stories. They're calling the book Wounds, obviously to tie in with a film. The original title of the book was The Atlas of Hell, and which is kind of more reflective of what the contents are. It'll have that story in it, of course, The Visible Filth, and it'll have five other stories, including one long novella, which are a little pulpier and a little more overtly fantastical than the stories in North American Lake Monsters.
Okay.
And that's April 9th.
All reprints or any originals?
The novella is going to be original, the new novella. It's called The Butcher's Table. It's about 30,000 words long. That's original, the other than five reprints.
Great. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't have a quick question, if you don't mind. So I'm a parent myself. How old is your daughter?
She's 18. She's in college now.
Okay. So not anything you need to worry about in terms of, you know, because I know a few authors that I've talked to who write things that shade towards horror. And, you know, they're like, yeah, so kids, I published this book, but you really shouldn't read it yet. Or
yeah.
I was just thinking about that visit to the film set. I mean, that's got to be an odd experience.
Mm-hmm. The visit to the film set was odd. She was 17 at the time. So I think nothing to worry about there. And it was a pretty, I mean, they weren't shooting anything like really extreme that day. It was pretty generic stuff on that particular day. But as far as the stories go, yeah, there was definitely a time when I didn't want her to read it. And she hasn't expressed much curiosity. I think that she probably will eventually. But, mm-hmm. you know, I think she has a kind of a sort of healthy disinterest in what her what her parents are up to. Mm-hmm. I was going to say just once, like when she was 16 or 17, she kind of flipped idly through the book once and I guess saw a couple paragraphs. She says, oh, I don't want to think about my dad thinking about that stuff. And so decided,
yeah, yeah.
She wasn't
that sounds
read
like
it.
A healthy teenager reaction.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah, I have to admit my kids have zero interest in anything I write. But it's funny, when I'm doing chores around the house and I'm listening to all these other podcasts, and then one time, you know, just to check the sound quality, I was playing my own podcast and all of a sudden my oldest, who's seven, he's like, wait, you podcast? Like that, hearing my voice come out of a place where he's only used to hearing like NPR people was that got his attention.
Oh, it's funny. The world's different. Yeah. If I had a YouTube channel, she might be interested.
Right. Exactly.
Oh my goodness. So after this is already quite a busy year between the film and the new book. But what else is on the horizon for you?
Well, I'm working on two novels. One of which I sold along with a short story. Mm-hmm. Still have to finish it, and I hope to have that done by the spring, somewhere at the latest. Mm-hmm. I think I'm pretty close.
Good.
Which is not a horror novel.
Really?
Yeah, it's just kind of strange. Strange, I guess, maybe coming from me. It takes place on Mars in the 1930s. It's about a teenage girl and her dad. Obviously, you know, it's not hard to figure out where that idea came from, and. And just about isolation and about how this community has been cut off and they're trying to figure out how to continue. Mm-hmm. It'll have some darker elements to it, but it's definitely not going to be a horror novel. The other one that I'm writing maybe is, but it's a little too soon to tell. Whether or not something is horror is not something I really think about a lot when I start to write. It often turns out that way, but it's not, you know, I don't often go in with that intent.
Okay. That's interesting, because sometimes people do think that we very much adhere to the boundaries of genre, but sometimes you don't know what a story is going to be until you start telling it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think they often end up that way just because, like I said before, it's just how I'm, you know, my mind is tilted. Mm-hmm. I just respond really well to that sort of spooky aesthetic. It makes me happy. My happy place is those old cartoon haunted houses with the ghosts coming out the windows and the bats and the full moon. I love that. and so that's just the way I drift. But that doesn't mean it'll always be that way.
Hmm. Well, that's kind of cool, because I am interested to see what flavor you're going to give to someone that's not horror. I think that it won't be too different, because to me, a lot of what I just simply consider to be strong writing is already present in what I'm reading that is horror. So I don't think there's going to be any kind of massive shift. But it will make it more accessible to us scaredy cats. Right.
I hope so.
Okay, with that, I mean, Karen, was there anything else you wanted to touch on about the story or anything else that we didn't get to?
Not that I can think of. I definitely wanted to be sure to get all the information about the stuff he's doing this year, because this looks like a really exciting year. Hang on. Tell them what your Twitter handle is so that they can also rejoice in these reviews and such.
N Ballingrud. N-B-A-L-L-I-N-G-R-U-D.
Okay, perfect. That's it from me.
Okay, and so with that, I want to thank Nathan so much for coming on. We really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Great. Cool. And Karen and I are not quite sure yet what we're going to be doing next, but with any luck,
it's going to be marvelous.
Exactly. Absolutely. We'll get it figured out in the next month or so, and we'll be back on your podcast feed. So with that, thank you all for listening, and we will see you next time.